Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Cleveland, Ohio, a number of decades ago, is one of the five wealthiest cities in America, and there were millionaires everywhere in manufacturing. Today, Cleveland's one of the two or three poorest cities in America. And what's happened is this sort of systematic deindustrialization starting in the 1980s through this financialized system. And the way to address that is to root ownership locally. You know, if you and I all worked in a business in Cleveland, Ohio, and we all owned that business and it was anchored in our neighborhood, it's very unlikely that we would all get together, you know, in the lunchroom and say, I've got an idea. Let's ship our jobs to Phoenix or to Mexico or somewhere else.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't be talking about that over lunch or any other time. And yet, as you'll hear from our guest Ted Howard and from Ellen, that very idea of shipping jobs elsewhere is one of the most common steps corporate profiteers take to make more money for themselves and shareholders. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. On today's program, we rejoin Ellen's conversation with the Democracy Collaborative's Ted Howard, which has been centrally involved in creating a transformative model of corporate ownership to nurture community wealth and economic sustainability. The idea is that communities and workers are best served when workers are incorporated in ownership by the corporate employer and when those companies are headquartered locally. Ted and co-author Marjorie Kelly have a new book out called The Making of a Democratic Economy, which takes a look at how we can rebuild America's productive core and move past the economic and social deterioration of a financialized economy that leaves most citizens out. My conversation with Ellen delves into how this economic dysfunction has put us at a significant global disadvantage compared with the rising economies of Asia, such as China, Korea, and Japan. These systems employ state involvement through their banking institutions, enabling them to better adapt to support and accommodate changing economic needs. Later in the program, we go back to North Dakota, which is in the middle of celebrating the 100th anniversary of its renowned public bank, the Bank of North Dakota. But first, let's check in with Ellen.
All right. Well, here we are in the middle of a very hot summer. It seems like the temperature is rising in a lot of the issues that our society is facing, some of them being monetary, and it seems like many of them stemming from the leadership of the country at the moment. We've got a trade war underway with China, which the leadership seems to think is going to produce some results, but so far seems to have only raised prices, compromised markets for farmers, and now worked on currency competitions. And then there is this matter, growing problem in Venezuela, where the administration wants to really start an all-out war with Venezuela by freezing its assets. These are very provocative, pugnacious positions. And China being really one of the biggest targets of concern for us, your new article, Ellen, is called The Trade War, A Contest of Models. Tell us about what those models are that you see facing off at this time.
Well, last week, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates, which people were wondering why that was, considering that theoretically all the official data are pointing upwards. And under the Fed's reasoning, which one might question, but anyway, under their models, they should have been raising rates in those conditions. But apparently the explanation was that we're in a trade war and a currency war, and other central banks are cutting their rates, and so the Fed has to do the same thing in order to prevent the dollar from getting too strong relative to other currencies. The theory being that if we have a strong dollar, then it's harder to sell our products abroad, and that hurts our workers. President Trump declared that we would be imposing further tariffs on China as of September 1st, and China responded. It's a question whether they retaliated, but anyway, China then took the step of no longer supporting its currency. People said they manipulated the currency, but in fact they always manipulate it. They manipulate it up in order to prevent it from falling too low. But in this case, they said, well, fine, if you think our currency is overvalued, we're just going to let it go. And it dropped below levels that they had said they wouldn't let it drop below. And so President Trump said that was currency manipulation. Anyway, the stock market immediately responded by the worst day we've had all year on the stock market. On the Dow, it dropped by 767 points. So anyway, we're now apparently in a full-fledged currency war. But the problem is currency wars don't work. I mean, everybody loses in a currency war. And we know that looking back on in the 1930s, when they had the same sort of competitive devaluations that just made the Depression deeper. And as Michael Hudson pointed out in an interview he did on Guns and Butter with Barney Faulkner, the U.S. really didn't have that many products to sell abroad. So we're really just hurting, as you pointed out, we're really hurting our own farmers and our own workers who have to pay more when the dollar is devalued relative to others. But what I was really writing about was, what's this trade war all about, and why can't we seem to reach a deal on trade? It's really a challenge of the Chinese model, which is that their government supports their banks and supports their industry. Well, it owns the banks. It owns 80% of the banks. And the banks make below-market loans to the state-owned enterprises, well, to all their businesses, but particularly the state-owned enterprises, and most of them are state-owned. And they support their workers with nearly free higher education. They have a national medical system, and they have cheap transportation. So costs are much lower for the workers, and therefore they can afford to work for less. It doesn't mean their standard of living is less. So the government does all that for the people and for the businesses, and that's their model. It's an improvement over the communist model, which was that the government owns everything. That obviously didn't work. And in the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union is said to have fallen just from internal things that didn't work. You know, it fell on its own sword, basically. Whereas the Chinese model is much more efficient. It's working brilliantly well. In fact, for the last 40 years, they've had amazing, consistent growth in GDP. And they've brought a huge number of workers up from poverty into the middle class. So it's working very well for them. And what we're basically saying is, that's not fair. You're supporting your industries and you're supporting your workers. And so we want your workers and your industries to have to struggle like ours do. But it was the free market model that actually hollowed out our own manufacturing base and our own economy. So it's like, we want to reduce them to our level. And that's what the question is, our model versus their model.
Michael Hudson, whom you quote in the article, really characterizes that in a succinct way. You quote him as saying, you know, this is the fight that Trump has against China. He wants to tell it to let the banks run China and have a free market. He says that China has grown rich over the last 50 years by unfair means, with government help and public enterprise. In effect, he wants the Chinese to be as threatened and insecure as American workers are. They should get rid of their public transportation. They should get rid of their subsidies. They should let a lot of their companies go bankrupt so that Americans can buy them. They should have the same kind of free market that has wrecked the U.S. economy. That's what Michael Hudson says.
And the whole thing goes, you know, if you trace it farther back, it goes back to the Japanese model, the state-guided market capitalism, which was a great improvement over the communist system. The Japanese realized you didn't have to own everything. You just have to own the commanding heights. And the commanding heights, as they saw it, was the banks, which generate the credit. So if you control the banks, if you can control policy where the bank lending goes. Basically, if you have a public banking system, which is what we're all about, of course, then you can make the economy very viable, but you do it by funding private businesses. So you have, or, you know, they could be private or state-owned, but anyway, the businesses are making their own decisions. You're just giving them credit for specific things below market rates. So that worked really well for the Japanese, and it worked so well that the other South Asian countries started doing it, like particularly Korea, and they came up from nowhere amazingly. And China also got this idea from Japan. So the Western bankers, of course, well, we managed to bring down the Soviet Union through the Cold War. And then the talk was that, well, maybe the former Soviet countries could adopt this Japanese model. And this was considered a big threat to the Western neoliberal free market system. So our economists managed to infiltrate. Anyway, they somehow the neoliberal model snuck in there, and they did open up their capital markets to investment from the West. And then we had the 1997-98 Asian crisis when our speculators went in, and like George Soros went in and managed to take their countries down. But China didn't fall for that. So China is now the last man standing. So we've been working on them ever since, trying to worm our way in there. So, well, I quoted an article in Foreign Affairs where they're saying, well, we're not going to be able to bring down China the way we brought down Russia. They didn't say it in so many words, but that's what they meant. Like, okay, China's too big. We're going to have to, like, be nice to them. We're going to have to figure out how to cooperate. But we just want to make sure that they adopt our model, basically. So that's what the whole issue is, whether it's our model or their model, or could we not live in peaceful coexistence. And what I would suggest is their model actually in that particular area of banking is better than ours, and we should adopt that. I mean, we should say, great, thank you very much, shake hands. Thanks for showing us how we could run our system better, and we could all get along, and we could all be doing it.
Would seem to be obvious, but for the fact that our model is owned by powerful private interests. The logic of using that model speaks for itself, but you know, the powerful resistance that's showing up to control the monetary future of you know, the economic future of the planet, it's coming from the people who own our model.
Right, and all the commentators you hear, they're all on the business channels, and it's all about your investment, so it's all about the stock market. Well, that's us, financialization. It's us, like, creaming profits off the top of our own companies. That's really what's hollering out our companies. So you don't hear it from the workers.
The workers here are the ones who are the peons and the pawns in this game of power posturing, that we should really all be in favor in supporting the Chinese and the Japanese and the model of that you're referring to.
And my concern is I'm actually speaking at a conference in Korea this fall, and the Japanese, you know, they've all sort of fallen for the Western model, and there's concern that China is going to do the same, open up their banking system to our Western bankers.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. And also, let's hope that we can last long enough to make the changes necessary. Well, Ellen, thank you for this new article. Of course, it's going to have a couple of different titles by the time it gets published, but The Trade War, A Contest of Models, the evidence is that our model is failing and has been ever since it was taken over by the neoliberals with Reagan and Thatcher and so forth that have undermined the real heart and the power of our economy, which is the welfare and the well-being of the people. Well, thank you, Ellen.
Okay. Always great to talk to you.
We just heard Ellen talk about how the neoliberal, market-driven, private profit-focused economic model is being outperformed by a number of more successful Asian-based state-supported systems. One is on the rise, the other, ours, is falling behind. The general state of well-being and economic security is under threat in the U.S. at several levels of financial security, including home ownership, college and medical expenses, and other indicators of a strong public life. Our market-driven, profits-above-all system has hollowed out our economic prospects by deferring to corporate ownership and shareholder interests that reflect very little concern about worker interests or community interests. We now rejoin Ellen's conversation with Ted Howard, the president and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and author with Marjorie Kelly of the new book, The Making of a Democratic Economy. Ted talks about the pivotal difference that a place-based economy makes in creating lasting economic stability and that nurtures lasting community wealth. It stands in stark contrast to the effects of the financialized corporation whose loyalty to local concerns and communities is subject to change based on profiteering speculations.
What you're pointing to is what has also been called the casino capitalism, where, I mean, you said people only own the stock, these investors, for 5 minutes. Sometimes they own the stock for 5 seconds. And
right.
These huge decisions are being made that impact the lives of workers and companies, but deeply impact the communities around the country. And that's why we've called this economy that we're currently living under an extractive economy. It's literally sucking wealth out of our communities and centralizing it in more and more hands. And, you know, Cleveland, Ohio, again, where I actually live in Cleveland, most of my staff is in Washington, D.C., but in Cleveland, Ohio, you know, a number of decades ago, it was one of the five wealthiest cities in America. John D. Rockefeller was born in Cleveland, and he's buried here. And there were millionaires everywhere in manufacturing. Today, Cleveland's one of the two or three poorest cities in America. And what's happened is this sort of systematic deindustrialization of the community. It's been going on since the 60s, but really picked up starting in the 1980s through this financialized system. And the way to address that is to root ownership locally. You know, if you and I and 50 people listening to this podcast all worked in a business in Cleveland, Ohio, and we all owned that business, and it was anchored in our neighborhood, I mean, almost like you could walk to work kind of thing, it's very unlikely that we would all get together, you know, in the lunchroom and say, I've got an idea, let's ship our jobs to Phoenix or to Mexico or somewhere else. You know, it's in your community, it's rooted, it belongs to you, and it's a community asset. That's why we at the Democracy Collaborative talk about building community wealth. We don't think wealth is a bad thing. And a lot of people, you know, they sort of say, oh, you shouldn't talk about wealth. I think wealth's a good thing. I just think it's also centralized. We need to find a way to build wealth in our communities. And that's not only for individuals, but it's for the whole of the community. So if you have a business there and the owners of it live there and they see themselves not only as the beneficiaries of the capital of the business today, but as the stewards of the capital for their children and their grandchildren and beyond, and that's a much healthier situation than all these footloose companies running around with no loyalty to our communities. You know, we've gotten so far away from place, and the democratic economy says that place is essential, that all economic activity occurs in real places and communities, and it's designed for their benefit, whereas the extractive economy has markets that are completely disembodied and global and not linked to place, and place is simply seen as a site of extraction. And that's a kind of fundamental difference that underlies these two paradigms of economic activity.
Yeah, and yet you can see why we went to the corporate model. In other countries, they're talking about they should sell, businesses should go public, sell off their stock as a way to raise capital. Yet what they do now is more borrow from banks. But the problem is that they can't, like a small local business in the U.S. now has a lot of trouble getting a low interest, you know, a modest price loan from a big bank, which just doesn't care about your local your local businesses. And that's another thing that's important in the public banking movement, is making credit available at low cost to local businesses. These are loans that are profitable. You know, we're not talking about taking a loss on your loans, but they're maybe not as profitable as the big corporation loan or the big hedge fund loan or whatever. So if your bottom line is you have to make the most money possible for your shareholders, you've got to go for the big loan and just ignore those little loans, even though you can at least break even and turn some modest profit on them. So that's what a public bank is, just has a different mindset. You know, its goal is to support the community without going, we still make some profit, but to make the profit for the community and make, you know, consider the good of the whole community and not just of the private shareholders.
That's so well said. I mean, that's the spirit. You know, this next election in 2020 in the United States, you know, obviously, you know, Donald Trump wants to have this fought as, you know, he is all for free market and this free economy and so forth. And then there are all these other people, they just want state control of everything. And that's not the distinction at all. There's a real important place for public ownership. But what we're talking about overwhelmingly are businesses rooted in place and in communities that are not predicated upon maximizing shareholder value for the investors and everyone else be damned. So in our evergreen companies, I was the worker cooperatives that I helped start here in Cleveland, those companies have a dual purpose, and it's built into their charter. One, they obviously need to provide professional goods and services and make a profit so that people can have wages and profit sharing and all that. But the companies also have a commitment to create the same opportunity for decent work and good jobs and democratic workplaces for other people in the community who aren't yet employed. And so each company agrees to stream 10% of their profit to a nonprofit holding company, and which then uses it to develop new businesses in the communities so that other people can benefit. Most companies are not thinking in that way, and that's just a different mindset and a different principle. And yet these are going to be profit-making companies, and they have a CEO and a board, but they have different values. So for instance, in our evergreen companies, the pay ratio between the CEO and the entry-level worker is set at about 5-1. The typical Fortune 500 company, the CEO in a recent year was making 301 times the salary of the entry-level worker.
Wow.
That's just wealth extraction from the company. It's a design principle that we're looking at. How do you intentionally design companies and banks and financial systems and so forth that have these values that reinforce place, that reinforce equity, that, you know, benefit people, that have embedded in them a sustainability perspective, so that it's not just, you know, dump all your waste in the community and treat it as an externality. So these are design principles, and again, what we're saying in our book is it's a storytelling book. We're seeking to change the narrative around the economy by showing how this is actually being done by people just like you and me and anyone listening to this podcast.
I can remember Gar saying, I've gotten to interview him several times, and I remember him saying one problem with the cooperative model is that although your cooperative business may have environmental values, social values that incorporate built in, the problem is you're competing with other companies that don't. So other companies may be dumping waste into the local river or whatever, you know, cutting corners. And so if you don't cut corners, then you're going to be squeezed out of the market. So I think for that, so we need change at both levels. Like, we need more awareness of what can be done at the local level so people actually do it themselves. Like, in public banking, when we talk about the local level, we're still talking about local legislators, but you're talking about workers who can just change their own company, basically, like, without getting government involved at all. But it seems to me you still need some local laws or even federal laws or whatever that enforce whatever, protecting the environment or whatever we all agree on that needs to be done, you know, in the community or at different levels.
That's exactly right. So public policy, laws, regulation, they're very important in this whole process. And cities can, for instance, reinforce this. They can, you know, when a worker cooperative in a community that, you know, maybe it's providing, you know, some sort of good or service, but it has an environmental concern. When the city puts out contracts, for instance, for vendors, they can award extra points to that company because it's a good environmental citizen. They can reinforce that. So that's one way. You can provide that sort of thing. You can incentivize companies to move in this direction. The the tax code can enable for better transitions to worker ownership. We worked with Senator Gillibrand of New York, her office, to help formulate a law that passed and was signed into law, piece of legislation called the Main Street Employment Act, and it had one very simple element, which mandated the Small Business Administration, the SBA, which has small business development centers all over the country. There are 900 of them, half of them at universities. And every year they come in touch with about 1 million local businesses and entrepreneurs who are coming to them for technical assistance and advice. And this act mandates that these centers will make information about employee ownership available to everyone who comes to them for technical assistance for their business. And that was just a very simple tweak of how an agency does business that all of a sudden gives you 900 places all over the country that can provide strong information and technical assistance to businesses to move in this new direction. So there are laws, administrative changes, regulations, all of that is very, very important, absolutely.
This is on a sort of different subject, but it's just something I noticed. You said on page 89 of your book that you were talking about the Green New Deal and that there were negotiations underway to combine the Green New Deal with QE for the planet, which would be a form of quantitative easing that would go into the real economy. But I had an exchange, which I think is great. I definitely think we've got to get them to get on board with quantitative easing. But I had an email exchange with one of the organizers of the Green New Deal, who said that they really aren't focusing on quantitative easing, that they thought it had failed, and that their current economic advisors were recommending modern monetary theory and basically fiscal policy, just have the government spend more deficit spending, and that we could do a lot more deficit spending without actually creating hyperinflation as everybody thinks would happen. But it seems to me I do have one issue with modern monetary theory. I mean, I totally agree. We've got to get more money out there. We can spend more, all that stuff. But it's got to work in tandem with the Federal Reserve. I mean, you can issue all the money you want, but you've got to have your central bank buy that money up if you want to actually create new money, and particularly interest-free, debt-free money. Otherwise, you're just going to run up your interest bill on the federal debt to unpayable levels where already it's taking up a big chunk of the budget and will take up a lot more in a decade or so if we keep going further and further into debt at interest. So anyway, it seems to me what we need to do, it's another law that we need to change at the federal level, which is to allow, instead of saying that the Fed is totally independent and can do what it wants, we should do like the Japanese, which their law is actually different. It says that the central bank is supposed to work together, cooperate. Like you say, together we're stronger. Well, we should have the central bank and Congress cooperating
to have fiscal policy that's funded by monetary policy. In other words, have them work together. So, and you're there at the federal level, and if you are talking to the Green New Deal people, I just want to make that point. Maybe you could stress that we really need to have some changes in the law in order to get the Fed and Congress to work together.
That's brilliant. We should get you in front of a committee talking about this, Ellen. That's terrific. You're absolutely right. And I will do what I can to reinforce that. Yeah, I do want to say, while our book really tells stories of communities, you know, the Pine Ridge Reservation and what the Oglala Sioux are putting together in terms of a community wealth strategy on a reservation where the unemployment is, you know, 80, 85, 90%, or inner city Cleveland, or in the Bronx with the largest worker co-op, Cooperative Home Care Associates, of more than 2,000 women in a cooperative so that they can do home care for people who need it in a very exploitative industry but still get good wages. And so while we tell lots of those stories, and that's the intent of the book, it is absolutely true that the kind of policy and legislative reforms that you're pointing to are absolutely needed. As you know, it's like both sides of the hand. You need the models and all that, but you've got to have the legislative piece. And you've, in this podcast, have pointed to a number of places where that's exactly the right thing. The big problem we have is, I go back to how our legislative process has been captured by these corporate capital interests, and that's why this whole effort for a democratic economy, in order to achieve those changes that are so desperately needed, really needs to turn into a kind of political movement, like there have been movements in the past in this country for fundamental change.
Yeah, I agree. We probably need another political party. I mean, we've had a two-party system for 100 years, but before that, there was the Populist Party, and it was actually a political party that got the Bank of North Dakota passed. First, they had a political party that the nonpartisan league that was just formed a couple of years before that, and it just inspired the country and won an election, and then they managed to get their bank passed. Whereas right now, when we try to get these public banks set up at a local level, we come up against all sorts of pushback from big banks and, like you say, other interests that are already controlling the government. So I think we do need a party. And you've done a lot of networking, a lot more than we've managed to do, which I think is great. You have an excellent appendix where you've listed different groups that could get together, that could be networking together. You said that we have a movement going on, but it's a silent movement. The players are siloed and don't really know that the others are out there, so we need to network it with each other. One problem we've had, I mean, I think, or you mentioned this too, that often groups feel competitive with each other. They wind up putting each other down. I remember reading a book on why the alternative healthcare movement failed in the 1990s. The doctors were all, they'd all been trained in the same system, and they were all marching in lockstep, and they wouldn't testify against each other in court. And they just mowed down the alternative people who were actually shooting at each other. They all thought that they had the way and that the others were quacks. It seems to me the first thing we have to do is agree on basic principles. Like in the money reform movement, I've had personally, you know, issues with, I mean, other money reformers have taken shots at me because we don't agree on the solution. And so, I mean, I've tried to not shoot back. I just keep pushing on. That is a roadblock, it seems to me, is that first we've got to establish some fundamental principles that everyone agrees on, and then just sort of ignore our differences and sign them up. But so how do you propose going around about networking and building a bigger and bigger movement so that we might actually have a political party that might actually succeed?
Well, the Democracy Collaborative next year celebrates its 20th anniversary. And when we began this, you know, there wasn't a field within economic development called community wealth building. You had, you know, cooperatives over here, and they thought the employee ownership people weren't pure enough. and then the employee ownership people had no connection to the land trust people and the public banking sector, and everybody was in their silos. So I quite agree with you that this principles and our values that we share are what we really need to grapple with and struggle over so that we understand our commonality. And then we have different forms and different approaches. And, you know, I don't claim to know exactly what the construction of the new system beyond this kind of hyper-capitalism should look like. But I think we can see a lot of the outlines and principles and so forth. So I agree, becoming very clear on what we're standing for in principle, not just the form of structure we're advocating for, is very important. And then we need a lot of experimentation. Then that whole field, as it's developed all over the country, and it really is all over the country, it needs to start to get married with the kind of explosion of progressive politics that we're seeing in this country. You know, there were just, you know, elections in Chicago, and a very progressive slate actually represent members of the Democratic Socialist Alliance of America, you know, the Bernie Sanders kind of end of the Democratic Party, just swept into power in Chicago along with the mayor. And we're starting to see people running for office. So I think there's a lot of positive energy on the progressive side that is entirely consistent with building a democratic economy. The problem is, I think, lots of the people running for office still, they're very good on lots of the social issues that we care about, and gender and race and even environmental and so forth, but they haven't really grappled very much with the economic issues and confronted that there's something structurally at the heart of the system. I'm all for instance, the fight for $15 an hour to raise the minimum wage. Absolutely. But we shouldn't think that if we do that, that is going to get us out of the deep fundamental economic crisis and box that we're in. It's very important to do, but we have to go far beyond that and really talk about who owns the economy. So I think that the energy is moving in our direction. On one hand, you could say there's a very dark time in America, and God knows, just watching the news on a daily basis, it can seem very, very dark. On the other hand, almost the darkness and coming out of the recession of 10 years ago, it's unleashing people's imagination and willingness to experiment and to think boldly. And so in some ways, I'm very heartened about what this time's about and perhaps how fast some of these ideas can move, as you yourself indicated when you sort of plotted some of the evolution of the thinking that went into the public banking movement that exists right now.
Yeah, to us it seems so slow. You know, we've been trying to get these bills passed for a decade. But I remember people writing to me and saying how fast it has moved. I remember a money reformer writing to me from England quite a while ago, actually, and she said, "You don't know how lucky you are." She said, "We've been trying to get these ideas out there for, I think, ever since the 1920s. She was a social creditor. And, you know, the time is ripe. People are ready to listen to new ideas. And we've got the internet where you can learn so much more than you used to be able to learn. You can, you know, you can do your own research. It really is exciting times in terms of possibilities and change."
That's exactly right. And also we need to acknowledge that, again, a place like Cleveland, Ohio, which has seen a kind of collapse of the economy and the extraction of this once wealthy community's wealth, that process of extraction and collapse has been going on for over 50 years. So, you know, we can't think that, well, in 5 or 6 years, we're going to turn around the whole situation. So this is serious. And as my colleague Gar Alperovitz says, you know, if you want to play this game of this sort of fundamental transformation of a system, you know, the ticket in is you need to put decades of your life on the table. And I know you personally, and I know I have, at our ages, we've been putting decades of our life, and now the younger people are going to need to do the same. At the same time, the last chapter of our book is about a small community of 150,000 people in England called Preston, which is an older industrial city. And I first visited Preston in December of 2012. I was invited by city leaders to come there and to talk about a democratic economy and community wealth building and so forth. This is a city very hard hit, I mean, in just terrible shape. We call it in the United States a rust belt, older industrial city. And the leaders of the city and the institutions, the university and the police administration and the city council and others got together and they said, we're going to make changes here. And they started building, they're working to build a public bank. They're investing $100 million of public pension money in the local economy. They've changed purchasing to bring 70 million pounds of money that used to go outside of Preston back into the city to buy locally and on and on. And in just 6 short years, Preston has gone from in the bottom 20% of the most deprived communities in all of England to this year, PricewaterhouseCoopers, not exactly a far left-wing, you know, operation, PricewaterhouseCoopers assessed community improvement in the United Kingdom and named Preston as the most improved city in the entire country. So in 6 years, it went from the bottom 20% most deprived. Then they implemented a strategy to build a democratic economy. They're still early days. But in just 6 years, they've been named by a leading capitalist organization as the most improved community in the country. So it shows that while we need to be in this for the long haul, we can actually make substantial changes fairly rapidly if we deploy all of the tools and strategies that are now available to build and make a democratic economy.
That's very inspiring. All the stories in your book are very inspiring, and I really enjoyed reading it. Very provocative, made me think of different things that I hadn't thought about before.
I was just going to thank you. I have such respect for your work, so that you, if you found it provocative and thought-provoking, then I think Marjorie Kelly and I have done our job, and I hope others will as well.
Oh, that's great. And I wish you all the best with your book. And I think you're doing great work. And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Likewise.
I've been speaking with Ted Howard, president and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and co-author of a cutting-edge book just out called The Making of a Democratic Economy.
At the outset of this program, we heard Ted Howard tell Ellen that what we need in this country now is a sort of revolutionary grassroots movement that will reclaim the democratic power to determine who our country belongs to, the people or the private bankers. That sort of movement is exactly what took place 100 years ago in North Dakota, when Continental America's only publicly owned bank, the Bank of North Dakota, got its start. It's become a paragon of purposeful economic partnering and profitability. It's 100 years old exactly on July 28th. And it's interesting to note that it got started within 90 days after the enabling legislation was passed. So it's appropriate and helpful to take a short look at how that democratically driven institution got its start and what it dealt with along the way. In previous programs here, we've been discussing with the bank's centennial historian, Mike Jacobs, the many very interesting side stories associated with this historic development. We'll return to those side stories individually in future programs, but today we've asked Mike to share an overview op-ed that he wrote for the occasion in the newspaper that he used to serve as editor-in-chief, the Grand Forks Herald.
From the beginning of my research for a centennial history of the Bank of North Dakota, the question has been, how can a state so conservative, so very deeply red, establish, sustain, and grow a state-owned bank? It's a complicated question. Certainly, it's not because North Dakotans rushed off to embrace socialism, as the publisher of the Herald warned at the time, and ideologues and historians still sometimes suggest. State ownership is the definition of socialism, and the bank is owned by the state. The idea of the bank may have come from activists who were familiar with socialist ideology. These included Arthur C. Townley, who founded the Nonpartisan League, the farmers' movement that swept to power in 1916, and shortly established what it called the industrial program. The phrase has a Soviet smell to it, but the League presented it as an economic development plan. Townley himself had been a Socialist Party organizer, but the party and the man were not loyal to each other. When Townley began organizing the League, the Socialist Party expelled him. A number of League insiders were socialists, but League leaders rejected their ideas about governing the state-owned businesses. Nor were North Dakota voters attracted to the Socialist Party itself. Its best showing in a statewide election was 8% of the vote for president in 1912. Townley was undoubtedly sincere in his desire to make change. He made sacrifices for the League, but he is better understood as a disgruntled entrepreneur than as an ideological socialist. He took the organizing job after his flax farm failed, and as a League leader, he invested its funds in a number of schemes that had little to do with its program. One of his enterprises, the U.S. Sisal Trust, is examined in detail in the current issue of North Dakota History, published by the State Historical Society. Other Leaguers also had business interests. William Lemke, who wrote the legislation creating the bank, had invested heavily in land in Mexico. He involved a number of others in the scheme, including William Langer, initially the League's Attorney General, but later a vocal foe of the early League. In 1928, Langer resurrected the League as a personal political machine, but by that time the League was less interested in economic development than it was in farm relief. Langer's reputation stems from that era, not from his career with the initial NPL government. One real socialist among the Leaguers was Henry Martinson, star of a film about the League's rise called Northern Lights. Martinson served as Assistant State Labor Commissioner for many years, and he never abandoned his faith in what he called the revolution. The North Dakotans who voted for the League were interested in practical solutions to pressing problems, and the League provided one in a state-owned bank. This wasn't an original idea. The fledgling American Republic had a national bank, and in the 20th century, the Federal Reserve System was established. A number of states experimented with state-owned banks. These failed for various reasons. The idea of public banking was in the air, and in North Dakota, the idea took root. Conditions favored the North Dakota Bank, and the bank responded to a real need for capitalism in a developing economy, and its mission statement emphasized economic development. That hasn't changed. Almost a fourth of North Dakotans were immigrants when the League came to power, and many of them were familiar with cooperatives, credit unions, and even public banks. Some of its statewide candidates were University of North Dakota graduates who came in contact with progressive ideas on the campus. The adoption of initiative and referendum statewide aided the League, just as recall brought an end to its power in the state, though not to the institutions it developed. In the 1921 recall election, voters approved the bank but removed the League officials. The winning gubernatorial candidate vowed to continue the bank. The real catalyst, however, was a dysfunctional private banking system. The state had far too many privately owned banks, more than 800 of them in 1920 in a population of about 500,000. Many of them were seriously undercapitalized, and all of them were dependent on Twin Cities banks. At the same time, milling and transportation interests preyed on the state's farmers. A long effort to establish a state-owned terminal elevator failed, and frustrated farmers took matters in their own hands, accepting a program to develop the state's economy by using the state's own financial resources. Thus, the bank was born, and it has survived election challenges and court cases to reach its 100th anniversary. The bank opened for business on July 28th, 1919, and a celebration of its 100th year will take place in Bismarck on Monday, July 29th.
That's Mike Jacobs, historian for the Bank of North Dakota's Centennial Celebration and author of the centenary book, The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years. It's an excellent piece filled with great stories and photographs, and it can be obtained from the Bank of North Dakota's website, through your local booksellers, or online. I'd add that the Centenary's online material is particularly interesting and can be found at the bndstory.nd.gov. That's the Bank of North Dakota's website, bnd.nd.gov. We send our hearty congratulations to the leaders and the people of North Dakota who have stayed the course with this bank for all these years and which now inspires an entire nation with its efficiencies, successes, and contributions to the great state of North Dakota. We intend to follow its lead in reclaiming our own democratic power to create banks that serve the public interest. In the last few minutes of this program, we're going to take another historical retrospective, this one from our own public banking movement beginnings, which were inspired at the first conference of the Public Banking Institute held in Philadelphia 2012. It was a short speech by a young Canadian that has been heard a few million times because it clearly laid out the reality of how banking interests have taken over national public interests. Victoria Grant's simple renderings of what has taken place in Canada, the U.S., and other countries is worth revisiting. So here is 12-year-old Victoria Grant of Canada.
Have you ever wondered why Canada is in debt? Have you ever wondered why the government forces Canadians to pay so many taxes? Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why the gross national debt is over $800 billion? Or why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion? What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada. I will share with you three important points of reference, which will hopefully spark enough interest and concern for you to continue the research on your own and to engage your government to stop this criminal act against the people of Canada. First, we will briefly examine the Bank of Canada. Second, we will see how our banking system works today. And lastly, I will offer a viable solution that we can petition our government to implement. A very little known figure in Canadian history is J.O. Grattan McGeer. He was a lawyer, member of parliament, and mayor of Vancouver. His contribution to Canada is probably the greatest in our history. He championed the creation of the National Bank of Canada, whose sole purpose is to create and manage Canada's money. It was formed on July 3, 1934, and owned by all Canadians. Until the 1970s, because of the Bank of Canada, Canada's national debt was held at a constant, manageable level, until the government decided to implement what we now have as our modern-day banking system that is robbing the Canadian people. So how are they robbing us? Allow me to explain how our private banks and government work today. First, the Canadian government borrows money from the private banks. They then lend the debt-based money to Canada with compounded interest. The government then continues to increase taxation of Canadians year after year in order to pay back the interest on the exponentially growing national debt. What results is inflation, less real money for Canadians to spend into our economy, and the real money being used to pad the pockets of the banks. Also, the government gave the banks the ability to loan out money that doesn't exist in the form of loans. When a bank gives you a mortgage, which literally means a death pledge, or a loan, they don't actually give you money. They click a key on a computer and generate the fake money out of thin air. They don't actually have it in their bank vaults. Presently, the banks only have $4 billion on reserve, but they have loaned out over $1.5 trillion. To quote Graham Towers, each and every time a bank makes a loan, a new bank credit is created. new deposits, brand new money. Broadly speaking, all new money comes out of a bank in the form of loans. As loans are debt, then under the present system, all money is debt. What I find interesting is even Jesus, in Matthew 21, drove out the money changers in the temple because they were manipulating the currency to steal money from the people. The private banks are just like the money changers in Matthew 21. They are defrauding and robbing the people of Canada, thus their freedom, and they need to be stopped. How should the banking system work? In an infamous interview, Mr. McGeer asked Mr. Towers, "Can you tell me why a government with power to create money should give that power away to a private monopoly and then borrow that which Parliament can create itself back at interest to the point of national bankruptcy?" Mr. Towers replied, "If Parliament wants to change the form of operating the banking system, then certainly that is within the powers of Parliament." In other words, if the Canadian government needs money, they can borrow it directly from the Bank of Canada. The people would then pay fair taxes to repay the Bank of Canada. This tax money would in turn get injected back into our economic infrastructure, and the debt would be wiped out. Canadians would again prosper with real money as the foundation of our economic structure and not debt money. Regarding the debt money owed to the private banks, such as the Royal Bank, we would simply have the Bank of Canada print the money owing, hand it over to the private banks, and then clear the debt with the Bank of Canada. And yes, we have the power and lawful right to do so. In conclusion, it has become painfully obvious, even for me, a 12-year-old Canadian, that we are being defrauded and robbed by the banking system and a complicit government. What will we do to stop this crime? What will we do to ensure that the next generation will live free and clear of the debt-based economy that enslaves them to the banks? Margaret Mead said the following, and I hope that all of you remember this. "Never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." Thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.